Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Libya today, NATO forces struck Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli in retaliation for his renewed deadly attacks on rebels in the city of Misrata. And the U.S. announced it's considering sanctions against Syria after government forces there reportedly hunted down and killed opposition members in the city of Dara today. We're going to be speaking with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in a moment about that. But as conflicts still smolder in Afghanistan and Iraq, and new flames as we see spring up in Libya and Syria, death tolls can be numbing. So we want to start today by taking the time to peel back a recent headline. You remember last week, photojournalist Chris Hondros was killed along with Restrepo co-director Tim Hetherington just after the two had arrived in Misrata, Libya. Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen reminds us that Chris Hondros was central to a powerful story in Iraq, and with his death, all of the central characters have now been killed in war. His column yesterday was entitled The Fatal Touch of War, and Kevin Cullen joins us in the studio. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Although I have to say, I hate to welcome you back. Because
we're going to stop meeting like this.
I know. We have talked about every chapter in this terrible story and never really connected the dots after Chris's death last week until you did on Sunday. Let's start at the beginning. It all started with Chris Hondros' iconic photo from 2005. He was with soldiers of the 1st Brigade, 25th Infantry in Iraq. They were manning a checkpoint. An Opel sedan comes flying through, doesn't stop. What happens?
Well, the background to that is this group of soldiers was jumpy. They had lost a number of their brigade to suicide bombers. When they saw this car coming at them, they just waved it down, and it didn't slow down, and at some point they just opened fire on it. They weren't going to take a chance. And as soon as they started shooting, Chris started shooting. He was embedded with these guys. He got out of the Striker, which is a heavy armored personnel carrier, and just as they ran up to the car, I remember Chris told me he was right in back of, I think, the captain in that platoon. And they knew immediately as they got up there, because they could hear the kids crying in the back seat, and the parents were dead in the front seat. And it was just this horrible realization. And I remember Chris saying he was amazed he kept shooting, because he was aware what was he was immediately aware that this was not a bunch of insurgents. This was a family who were trying to get home because there was a nighttime curfew in Tal Afar.
Well, and one little boy, Rakan, in particular, he was 12 at the time, writhing on the ground. His spinal cord had been
severed. One of the bullets nicked his spinal cord and basically left him. He was a paraplegic.
Well, so Chris, as you said, it's in slow motion. It's horrific, but he keeps photographing. He follows Rakan to the local hospital there. But then he also tried to do something. He meets with his friend, the California humanitarian worker Marla Ruzica. They meet in a Baghdad cafe. He shows them these photographs, and she says what?
She says, we got to do something about it. Marla was a force of nature. Was, you know, at the time 28 years old, had only been in the humanitarian game about 4 years, but had very quickly established herself as the voice for Afghan civilians who were being, and Iraqi civilians also, who were being killed, injured, and displaced by war. Marla was instrumental in getting Congress to appropriate $10 million to pay for the families in Iraq and Afghanistan who were being hurt by our troops.
And by the way, we should say here at this point, Chris was also witness to how much this hurt the troops.
Oh, yeah.
They were howling. They were, they realized they'd shot a family.
But, you know, the other thing Chris told me, too, is that he goes, it's amazing how often those checkpoint shootings happened and civilians were killed, that soldiers did try to tune it out and not become emotional and act as if it's just part of war. And he wasn't saying that in a judgmental way. He was saying it that that's how a lot of these kids handle it. And at the end of the day, they were kids. Yeah. Most of the people who were firing the guns were 19, 20 years old.
But in this case, they were just howling about it.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously
they,
affected by
it. They were shocked.
Chris obviously affected. And now again, we have in the story as well, Marla. who, you know, decided to do something for Rakan. She, as you write, hectored, begged. He did too. Chris mm-hmm. Andres did too. They found a hospital in San Francisco. Marla sent him an email saying,
"We did it. We did it. We got it." Marla had worked in San Francisco as an activist, and she had contacts there. And Chris had, I think he told me, sent out something like 100 emails to anybody he could think of, because in that world, you bumped into diplomats, you knew people, you knew people from USAID, and they knew that they had to get Rakan out of Iraq because there were no rehabilitative services. He needed serious surgery, and they knew he couldn't get it there. And they were able to, he was lined up. They actually had a date with the surgeon in San Francisco. And then Marla and Faiz, her translator, were on the most dangerous stretch of highway in the world at the time, was Route Irish, and that's the road that connects downtown Baghdad with the airport. And there was a suicide bomber there, aimed actually at an American personnel carrier that was there. I think there was also another NATO force there. It might have been somebody from Australia or something, but they were clearly going after the military. Units that were on that road. It just so happened Marla and Faiz, her driver and translator, were there at the same time. The guy detonated, and Marla and Faiz were killed.
So now Marla is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. Rakan's, you know, in and of itself, it's terrible, but also it disrupts Rakan's journey to San Francisco. Fast forward, a disabled postal worker here in Rockland, Massachusetts, reads your account of Marla dying before Rakan could leave, and he writes the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Kennedy and Donald Rumsfeld, unlikely pair, team up to bring Rakan here to Boston, where Dr. Larry Ronan, head of the team at Mass General Hospital that cared for Rakan. You traveled to Iraq on other occasions with Larry Ronan, a pretty dedicated doctor.
Oh, unbelievable. He just hopped on a plane, went to Germany, picked up Rakan and brought him back and oversaw his care. And another great human being, Ray Tai, a humanitarian who died last year. Ray paid for everything. Just, you know, basically, Teddy Kennedy called up Ray, put the arm on him, said, "You got to do this." And Ray says, "Okay, I'll do it." So he paid for it. So you had this Jewish businessman who made his money in the liquor business taking care of this Muslim kid. It was just all these crazy stories.
And take care of him they do.
Yeah.
But Rakan really wants to go back to Iraq. Now, we spoke to Dr. Larry Ronan of Mass General Hospital at that time. He became very emotional. He got quite choked up, couldn't speak for several seconds when talking about Rakan leaving. And then I asked him why.
The life of a little boy or girl is priceless. So you just do it.
This is very emotional for you.
Huh. You don't like to see kids caught up in this.
Have you talked to Rakan?
Oh, sure. I got on the cell phone with him, and his English is still good. And I asked him how he was doing, and he's sort of a 12-year-old monosyllabic good. And then I said, is he good to be home? He says, yep. And I said, do you want anything? He says, yep. And I say, what? And he said he wants CD-ROMs and videos. So I have to send him the CD-ROMs and videos.
That's Dr. Larry Ronan of Mass General Hospital talking about the little boy Rakan that he cared for after he was caught in a shooting at a checkpoint in Iraq. He was shot, his family killed. He was shot by U.S. troops. And we've been talking to Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, how photographer Chris Andros, along with aid worker Marla Rizicki, helped Rakan get to Larry Ronan here at Mass General Hospital in Boston. As we just heard, Dr. Ronan caring for him, but he had to, you know, send him back when he wanted to go back and send him CDs. And then, Kevin Cullen, what happened to Rakan?
3 years ago, somebody put a bomb in the house of Rakan's brother-in-law, who he was living with. And the bomb exploded. Rakan was killed, and two of his sisters were injured but recovered. So to this day, we really don't know why Rakan was targeted, because we don't know if it's because he was the receiver of American aid, or if it had something to do with his brother-in-law worked guarding antiquities in Mosul, which is the Iraqi city which actually has the greatest extensive collection of antiquities for Iraqi civilization. We don't know if his position in which quasi-government, if that had anything to do. We just don't know. I haven't been able to get an explanation. All we know is that Rakan is dead.
So Marla, the activist who tried to get him out, was killed. Rakan is killed. And then last week, Chris Hondros, the photographer who brought him to everyone's attention, is killed. They're all
dead.
The futility.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's when I wrote that piece yesterday, Robin, actually, I almost used the phrase the futility of war, but I didn't have to because it was so it's kind of like self-evident if you read about these three lives, the intersection of them. You know, fate brought them together and war killed them. And, you know, when I heard news that a couple of photojournalists had been killed in Libya, I immediately thought of Chris. Chris was the name that popped in my head. I go, Jesus, I wonder if it's Chris. And then I found out a couple hours later it was.
Yeah. One of the things you write about in your conversations with him, he comes to Boston.
Yeah, he came to see Rakan.
He visited Rakan in the hospital. And as you write, knowing that he had been there with the soldiers, and he had taken the iconic photographs of this terrible tragedy. He told you at that time, Chris Hondros did, that he hoped someday Rakan, you know, could see the pictures with him and they could maybe talk about it. Did he ever have that chance?
No, he didn't. And there's no doubt that eventually would have happened had both of them lived. You know, I think Chris was of the opinion that Rakan had to get a little older to really be approachable on this. But Chris was always in that theater. He was always in that part of the world. He had an apartment in New York, but he was on the road almost all the time. And there's no doubt that they would have got together. But I think Chris also did the right thing by not really going into it that day in the hospital here in Boston, because I think Rakan was in the middle of some serious, you know, medical care. And to go into that, I think at the time, would not have been the right time. But like I say, Chris was very unusual like that. I think there's a defensive mechanism in a lot of war correspondence. I mean, I covered a couple of wars, and I couldn't do it. It's a really hard thing to do. Beyond the danger you put yourself in, it really tears you apart, or it tore me apart to see this happen to other human beings. And Chris, I think, was unusual in the sense that he had a tough—he was very brave, obviously, but doing that. But I think he had a toughness that was tempered by a sort of, like, the idea he never really gave up on this kid. He really wanted to help Rakan. Mm. I think a lot of guys, just from a self-defensive point of view, would have just moved on and go shoot the next war. But, I mean, he really stayed on top of this, and he really wanted Rakan to get better and to prosper. And, you know, eventually they were going to have that conversation. Unfortunately, they never did.
What about Rakan's family? Has anybody been able to, what's left of his family, anybody able to contact them about what happened to Chris Hondros or what?
No. In fact, people from NPR and the New York Times, I think, are trying to find them, but I wouldn't know where to find them because we lost contact. The number I had for Nathir doesn't work anymore on a cell phone. I don't know where they are.
It's just a story that slowly disappears.
Yeah.
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, we'll link you to his incredible column, yesterday's Fatal Touch of War. Kevin, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.